Introduction. Men aren't the enemy. This book began with a flight to Des Moines. In most ways, it was uneventful. The businessman sitting next to me couldn't have been friendlier. Over plastic cups of white wine, we chatted about his business, his new house in a New York suburb, and his kids' sports teams. Then I mentioned I was on my way to speak at a women's conference. Suddenly, my neighbor froze. "Sorry," he snapped. "Sorry, I'm a man." I looked down awkwardly into the bottom of my wine glass. My seatmate gave me a sideways glance and reached for an explanation. I had to go through diversity training a few months ago. It was awful. The words tumbled out of him. The facilitator had beaten up on him and his male colleagues, he said. It felt like being sent to the principal's office or being sat in the corner. Hours of his life wasted. And the message he and his male colleagues took away, he told me, boiled down to one accusation. It's all your fault. My seatmate's words struck me. The truth is, I'd heard some version of them dozens of times before. I'd seen the body language, the don't yell at me flinch, more times than I cared to remember. I'd watched self-assured, confident men curl into that defensive crouch when the subject of women, or God forbid the phrase gender equality, had come up. My seatmate and I spent the rest of the flight in awkward silence. The next morning, several hundred women gathered in a hotel ballroom. I had been invited to speak about some of the most common issues women face at work. Being overlooked in meetings, being underestimated, watching men getting credit for our ideas. As I spoke, I watched those several hundred female heads nodding in recognition. I stopped right in the middle of a sentence. "We already know all of this," I said. "We need men in this room to hear the message instead." First things first. There will be no man-shaming, and that's what she said. No male-bashing. No finger-pointing. For years, the fastest way to drive men from a room has been to mention women's equality. And who could blame them? The conversation implicitly made men the villain. Long before my epiphany in Des Moines, back in 1859, a Harper's Weekly cartoon depicted men cowering in a courtroom while suffragettes berated them. In an 1875 cartoon, a gaggle of women yell at a wincing man. Above the caption, "Female suffrage, male suffering." Men felt demonized. They still do. A recent Harvard study found that corporate diversity training has made the gender gap worse, in part because it makes men feel bad about themselves, which, as it happens, is what it was engineered to do. "We used to do it with a 2x4," Howard Ross, a veteran diversity trainer, told me. "We beat 'em up until they saw the error of their ways. If somebody cried, that was great." Women, meanwhile, have pretty much wiped our hands clean of men, cutting them out of the conversation altogether. An entire industry of books, conferences, and networking groups has blossomed to tell us that closing the gender gap is up to us, not them. We're told we need to speak up, to be more confident, to demand to be paid what we're worth. We talk endlessly among ourselves about all of this. What we don't do is talk to men about it. That disconnect between men and women makes no sense to me. If women only talk among ourselves, we can only solve 50% of the problem. We need men to join the conversation, to be our partners. And as for the men, most of them aren't anywhere near villains. They don't need beating up with a 2x4. They like to see an equitable workplace. They just can't figure out what they're supposed to do about it. As Intel's chief executive officer, Brian Krasnick, put it, "I have two daughters. I want them to have a world that's got equal opportunity for them." And yet men often recoil from the conversation about closing the gap. Some simply aren't interested. Others are sure they have no problem with women themselves. It must be some other guys who do. And some feel victimized, as if the very topic is an implicit accusation. They're sure the gap doesn't exist at all. That if anything, women are getting an unfair advantage when it comes to jobs and opportunities. Indeed, by some measures, outright hostility toward women has increased, or at least become more visible, over the past decade. It's been fanned both by the Wild West of the web, where misogyny and racism thrive, and by the same deep economic frustrations and rejection of political correctness that powered Donald Trump into the presidency. Misogynistic corporate cultures have flourished at companies including Fox News, Uber, venture capital firms, film studios, media companies, and more. Though when exposed, the result has been the ouster of top executives. The tech industry has been roiled by multiple sexual harassment scandals, and Hollywood, after producer Harvey Weinstein was accused by multiple women of sexual harassment and assault over a 30-year stretch, thousands of women in other industries came forward with their own tales of abuse. These trends are playing out on the world stage. One out of five men in a global survey of more than 17,000 people in 24 countries said that women are inferior to men. Almost half of women as well as men surveyed in Russia and India believe women to be inferior. And this was a survey done in 2017. Those attitudes make it even more difficult for men who do want to reach across the gender divide. When Robert Moritz, chief executive officer of consulting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, wrote a LinkedIn post about why the firm values diversity, commenters, professional men using real names, called his ideas repellent, an affront to every white man, and argued there's no such thing as a real business run by a non-white man. One suggested that he surrender his job to a diversity hire and stay at home as a house husband. It's no wonder that men feel stymied, fearful of speaking out on behalf of women. While he was a student at Harvard Business School in 2012, management consultant Kunal Mutti published a piece in the Huffington Post arguing for gender equality. "Man up," he wrote. "Men, just as equally as women, must take ownership of these family issues, which are core to American economic competitiveness." He offered five pieces of advice, including such common sense suggestions as learn the facts, do your job, at home, and get involved at the ballot box, in which he noted that the U.S. ranks an appalling 90th in terms of female representation in our national legislature. Even so, he had to take a hard gulp before pressing the send button. "It's hard for guys to do this," he told me later. "Men worry, do I know enough? Do I have the right to talk about this issue?" One of the biggest challenges from a guy's perspective is, how do we make these issues discussable? Indeed, plenty of other men would be happy to join in the conversation. They're just terrified of saying something wrong. When Catalyst, a nonprofit organization focused on working women, asked men what might undermine their support for gender equality, a stunning 74% cited fear. Fear of loss of status, fear of other men's disapproval, and most telling of all, fear of making a mistake. Men are walking around on eggshells. Telly Whitney, president and chief executive officer of the Anita Borg Institute for Women in Technology, has witnessed that phenomenon over and again during her organization's annual Grace Hopper Conference for Women in Technology. The confab attracts not only hundreds of women, but also male executives from the major tech firms, all of which are trying to recruit more female employees. "These men genuinely want to correct the gender imbalance in their industry," Whitney told me, "but they are intimidated and uncertain exactly how to act or what to say." When Blake Irving, the chief executive of GoDaddy, a web domain registry, spoke to the group about how he was trying to change the company's macho culture, including eliminating its notoriously sexist ads featuring barely clad women, participants attacked him on social media. "We have a lot of men come to Grace Hopper, and they feel very confused," Whitney said. "They'd like to help, but they feel like anything they try, they might get taken to task for." Those fears have only escalated in the past few years, when the tiniest gaffe can be instantly magnified by the internet echo chamber. Complicating matters further, the politics and vocabulary of inclusion, of not offending any outsider group, have made it more fraught than ever for men to engage in this dialogue. There are the dreaded microaggressions, hurtful, even if unintentional, slights. There are the controversial trigger warnings for potentially offensive material on college campuses. There are safe spaces where people can go to avoid upsetting interactions. Why wouldn't men, especially the white men who dominate the upper reaches of business, be spooked? Their fear isn't irrational. Researchers have found that when a man advocates for women's rights, Not only men, but women are infuriated and surprised. Wharton psychology professor Adam Grant, who has written about women's issues in collaboration with Facebook executive and Lean In author Sheryl Sandberg, says some readers have berated him. What business do you have writing about women? Gender experts Barbara Annis and John Gray note that men in their workshops are terrified that they'll screw up when they speak with women. The men often say they have a history of saying the wrong thing to women, a fear that can be paralyzing. They note it in their book, Work With Me, The 8 Blind Spots Between Men and Women in Business. Even one previous episode of unintentionally offending or upsetting a woman can bring back those horrible feelings from adolescence when boys are afraid to say the wrong thing to girls. The problem can be exacerbated when these men become bosses. In one survey, 79% of male supervisors reported worrying about giving women candid feedback and said they felt they had to provide guidance carefully and indirectly. The irony is that by self-censoring, the men don't give women the feedback necessary for the women to advance. What's more, that nervousness, that suppression of their natural instincts, makes it all the more likely that the wrong thing will pop out of their mouths. The men are baffled. They're uncertain. They feel awkward. And it all rolls up into steering clear of particular topics, or of women altogether. I've long been puzzled by this phenomenon. I've spent my career as a journalist working primarily with men. All of my mentors were men. Most professional men I've encountered truly believe that they are unbiased. And yet when the subject of women comes up, they are so uncomfortable or fearful of saying the wrong thing that they simply shut down. So where does that leave us? With a conundrum. Since neither side is talking openly to the other, lots of men are still clueless about the women they work with every day. Not intentionally, but wow. They unwittingly belittle us or ignore us or do something they think is nice that just infuriates us instead. Catalyst's survey found that an astonishing 51% of men cited lack of awareness about exactly which issues women are facing. No wonder almost 30% of women say they still face bias at work, half a century after John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act. In the male-dominated technology industry, that figure soars to 80%, with 60% also reporting sexual harassment. The majority of men, meanwhile, report that as far as they're concerned, discrimination doesn't exist. Sexism has already been solved. It's even worse for women of color, who face a double bind, discounted for both their gender and their race. Strike one for being female. Multiple studies have found that when a man and a woman are equally qualified for a job requiring math skills, employers are twice as likely to hire the man. And strike two for race. Women of color are far more likely to experience the prove-it-again syndrome, in which they have to work harder than coworkers and repeatedly prove their competence. A 2014 survey of minority female scientists found that an astonishing 100% reported experiencing bias. What's more, while women in the U.S. earn only 80% as much as men, the discrepancy for minority women is far steeper, just 63 cents on the dollar for black women and 54 cents for Latinas. Sociologists have scratched their heads about why this is still the case. Intellectually, we know it makes no sense. Women began earning college degrees in equal numbers to men more than 3 decades ago, and now earn more than half. So there's been plenty of time to fill the pipeline that leads to management jobs. When I graduated in the 1980s, my female friends and our male friends, too, assumed it would only be a matter of time and of mathematical certainty that women would ultimately hold half of leadership roles. We had competed equally in school. We had applied for and been offered the same entry-level jobs. A few days before graduation, my roommates and I wrote down our predictions for our lives. Where would we be in 10 years? Then we sealed our prophecies in an envelope. At the time, Carol was on her way to law school. Ira was soon to enter medical school. Miranda was headed to graduate school for Russian-Soviet studies. I had landed a job as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Peering into our own personal crystal balls, each one of us predicted that we would have satisfying careers and big families. It didn't occur to us that this might be an either-or proposition. Why would it? After all, we were on equal footing with the guys, and they respected us as equals. As far as we were concerned, the battle for women's rights was over. women had won. Some of the most prestigious and historically male-dominated companies that came to recruit on campus at that time were even hiring more women than men. When Lehman Brothers recruiters arrived, this was when it was still a king of the world investment bank, long before it almost crashed the economy, my friend Phyllis was one of the lucky ones to snare a coveted spot in its analyst training program. Showing up for her first day of work a few months later, she was surprised, and she laughingly admits, a little disappointed, to find that two-thirds of her entry-level class was female. The dating pool at work was thin. My friends and I didn't consider ourselves feminists. That was something of a dirty word among many young women at the time, conjuring images of man-hating women who didn't shave their legs. To us, that battle for equality was long over. Men and women would march into the future together, on equal footing. Our professors and administrators kept telling our class that we were the future. We believed them. After all, they didn't add any caveats. They didn't say that only the men would be leaders. They were talking to all of us. Yet, 3 decades later, the world hasn't turned out at all as we had imagined. We were wrong in our cavalier attitude toward feminists, those women who had sacrificed so much so that we could, unthinkingly, expect we could have it all. Not only were we wrong, but by assuming their fight wasn't our own, and assuming their battles were over, we inadvertently lost some of their hard-earned gains. Almost all of the women in that Lehman Brothers class ultimately quit the finance business, including Phyllis, who went on to earn an MBA from Stanford and then abandoned her business career to become a screenwriter. As for my suite mates, those little folded scraps of paper with our predictions couldn't have been more wrong. While we did marry and have children, half of us dialed back, quitting jobs or working part-time as we struggled to balance work and family, those who stayed found that guys whom we'd easily bested in school were suddenly bosses. At our 10-year college reunion, the men swanned around in cashmere sports jackets, sussing out which one of them had made bank managing director first. The women had already encountered obstacles and difficulties that we'd never imagined. My college friends and I are in some ways a microcosm of what's happened in the wider world. Even though women earn almost 60% of college degrees and more than half of graduate school degrees, they represent just 5.6% of S&P 500 chief executives and 18% of board members of Fortune 1000 firms. There are only 19% of law partners. A Rockefeller Foundation survey found that 1 in 4 Americans believes we will literally invent time travel before women run half of the Fortune 500 companies. According to a McKinsey WSJ analysis, at the rate we're going, it will take 100 years to reach parity in the executive suite. Globally, the situation is worse. The World Economic Forum estimates it will take 170 years to reach economic parity for women and men worldwide. This is an urgent problem, not just for women, but for men. If women participated equally with men in the workforce, American gross domestic product, the total value of the country's goods and services and a key measure of economic health, would increase by 5%, boosting the economy for all of us. Nor is this just an American problem. Europe and Asia are struggling with the same lopsided landscape. They desperately need more women working to jumpstart their sluggish economies. At least 8 European countries have passed quotas requiring 30% of board seats or more to be held by women, including Germany, Norway, Italy, Spain, and France. In the UK, new legislation will require big companies to publicly report the pay gap between men and women, a chasm that currently tops £300,000 over the course of a woman's working life. Japan rolled out a program called Womenomics to encourage more women to work, claiming it will boost the country's economy by 15%. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe calls women Japan's most underutilized resource. But as long as men are afraid or don't know how to talk about the issues, or just in the dark about women, we won't close the gap. Even the most well-meaning men have a long way to go. I recently attended an event for the 30% Club, an organization founded by British finance executive Helena Morrissey, that encourages companies to strive for 30% female representation on corporate boards. Research has shown that women's views are discounted until they make up almost a third of any given group. The event, The kickoff festivities for a mentoring program for promising mid-career women was hosted by Kenneth Jacobs, the chairman and chief executive officer of banking giant Lazard. We filed into the bank's impressive conference space high above Rockefeller Center, with waiters passing delicate sushi rolls and windows offering panoramic views of Midtown Manhattan. Jacobs took the podium and looked slowly around at the 100 or so audience members, an overwhelmingly female crowd in their best business suits. He paused. "Generally, I'm a pretty good public speaker," he finally began, "but I confess, tonight, I'm a little nervous. Here I am in front of a room full of women, and that's very unusual. I have to say, it's a bit intimidating." The irony wasn't lost on the room, or on me, either. Every woman there knew what it was like to be the lone female in a room full of men, and no woman, certainly not me, would confess to being frightened. Imagine any businesswoman taking a podium and starting her speech by saying, "Wow, here I am in a room full of men, and it's terrifying." That would be absurd. Only a powerful man could trot out that line as a conversational icebreaker. The fact that he didn't seem to realize the irony was emblematic of how far we have to go in bringing together men and women at work. It isn't just him. His one-liner is a common trope among men. At an awards luncheon for women in media, host Andy Cohen looked out at the Waldorf Astoria ballroom filled with more than 1,000 women and quipped, "I'm intimidated." One of the presenters, Michael Roth, chief executive of advertising giant Interpublic, took his place at the microphone and joked, "It's not often I represent diversity." Funny, sure, but also a reminder that these men and so many others don't have to think about what their female colleagues experience all day, every day. That's why, prompted first by that businessman on a plane ride to Des Moines, I realized how crucial it is for women to let men in on our secrets. And so I went on a quest to understand not just the challenges women face, but to discover what mystifies or perplexes professional men about the women they work with. My goal was to get to the bottom of issues that men face every day. Why women often don't speak up at meetings. Why they can seem tentative when they do speak up. Why there are so few qualified women in the management pipeline despite good faith efforts to recruit them. And then I went in search of solutions. I sought out male executives who are trying to get it right. I traveled across the U.S. and beyond in search of new discoveries, research, and real-life experiments. I focused on men, institutions, even countries that are actively trying to close the gender gap. What I found exploded everything I thought I knew about gender. Some of the most surprising revelations came from the unlikeliest of sources, from the Enron scandal, from brain research, from transgender scientists, from Iceland's campaign to feminize an entire nation. Together, these findings offer fresh insights into the way we relate to one another. My hope is that the information in this book will be helpful for men who want to sharpen their competitive edge and who could use some practical tips to help figure out and engage with women without judgment or blame. And for women, my hope is they'll come away with a new set of tools they can use to break down barriers right now. Women are accustomed to being passed over and marginalized. We're frustrated because despite lots of talk, there's been precious little action when it comes to gender equity. Yet in some corners, there has been remarkable progress, and I've sought to crack the code of how successful initiatives can take root. So consider this an invitation to join the conversation, to work together to close the gender gap. You may be alternately surprised, relieved, irritated, and delighted. But above all, my hope is that That's What She Said will become a rallying cry for both men and women, finally to take real steps toward closing the gender gap at work and in life. The people you'll meet in these pages don't pretend to have all the answers, nor do I, but their stories offer reason for optimism. We're on the cusp of a new way of thinking, one that unites men and women rather than divides us, at work and beyond.